I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Cross 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free. Across 110th Street, woman trying to catch a trick on the street. You betcha. Across 110th Street, you can find it all.
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Unleashed podcast, episode 41 here at the New Republic. Grierson, I want to ask you, what'd you dress up for as Halloween?
I actually did not dress up for Halloween, though that's actually not true because I am going to be doing a Halloween thing with my godchildren on Halloween night, so I will be dressing up as a doctor for that. Very simple. Because it's about the kids, not about me.
It would be nerve-wracking to dress up as a costume for children who have the powers of gods. It must be like that Twilight Zone episode, like the from the Twilight Zone movie where they're all in the house and there's the kid that can do whatever powers that they have, and you have to you're just trying to amuse them, even though they could destroy you at any moment.
Yeah, my whole attitude with my godchildren is to be respectful because of their godlike powers and not to mess with them. I'm very deferential to them. Any like thing that they say, I don't think, well, that's stupid. You're three. I'm very, very polite to them.
It's a smart play. It's really a smart play. I don't usually dress up for Halloween, but now that I have two small children, they sort of insist. So I'm in between games of the World Series. I'm flying back to Athens, Georgia, and dressing up as Batman because whatever, it's Batman. Like as far as they know, I am Batman. All right, this is the Grierson Unleashed Podcast, episode 41. Please, as always, subscribe to us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud, see us at The New Republic. Email us at GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com. And please make sure when you go to iTunes and subscribe to on iTunes to give us a review. If you give us the name of a review with the name of a movie you would like to see, we will review it on this podcast. This week we have two reboot movies because there's only one major release. And you know, I'm using the word major rather liberally right there.
There's finger quotes around that, right?
Yes, of course. People can see this on the podcast. So we have two reboot movies this week. The first of us comes from Buckeye Peas. Excellent listen, 5 stars. I am thoroughly envious of Grierson and Leach, and there, Buckeye Peas, is your first mistake, who get to make a living writing about my favorite interests, movies, and in Leach's case, sports and politics, too. As a loyal Deadspin reader, I'd happily follow these guys whatever medium they publish. Their reviews and commentaries are incisive and accessible, knowledgeable and comprehensive, but not pretentious. The podcast is easily digestible, too, and a perfect length for my commute. They also keep the Cardinals banter to a minimum. We're trying.
that's where we're really pretentious, yeah.
Yes. If I may, I would love for the two of them to revisit Jackie Brown, one of the movies that got me, quote, into movies as a teenager was Pulp Fiction, which remains one of my all-time favorites. In the years since, though, I've come to think of Jackie Brown might actually be Tarantino's best. I was wondering if they agreed. So, our first reboot movie this week is Jackie Brown. Reboot movie number two comes to us from One Doubles. One word, One Doubles. Great movie buff podcast, 5 stars. I have to say that I really enjoy listening to this podcast. Both have a different style, but they share a clear appreciation for cinema and good movies, and it's great to listen to. If you ever have the chance, I'd love to hear a review of Bottle Rocket. So, two 90s hits, Grierson. Today we're discussing Jackie Brown and Bottle Rocket.
And I just have to say really fast, I love both of those reviews. And both of those people were so incredibly polite in asking for the movie to be reviewed. Both of them were so incredibly gracious about asking if we would have the time to review those movies. So
that's because they're scared of us because, like your godchildren, we have godlike powers.
That's true.
All right, so but there's only one big release this week. Again, big in quotes. So we're going to talk about that in Inferno.
Professor Langdon, we need your help. 3 days ago, a man killed himself. We think it was part of something much bigger. There was a package in his pocket.
And what was it?
It's Dante's Inferno.
Dante defined our modern conception of hell 700 years ago.
But these circles of hell have been rearranged.
Why Dante?
Why this map of hell?
Dante. Dante's death mask.
Yes.
Inferno is the, if you're keeping score at home, third movie in the Robert Langdon film series. You know, Tom Hanks was on Colbert recently, and he was kind of like jokingly complaining about the fact that he's trying to make this group of movies be referred to as the Robert Langdon films, but nobody thinks of them as that way. They just think of them as the Dan Brown movies. I would respectfully counter Mr. Hanks by saying, I don't think anybody thinks about these movies as anything other than those dumb Da Vinci Code movies. This is the third one in the series, based on a Dan Brown novel. Once again, Tom Hanks plays, he's a linguist, I guess, Robert Langdon.
Sure.
he's like, this is one when I wrote the review for us for The New Republic. And this was one of those cases where I had to do copious research because I kept thinking, he's a professor of like trivia? What is he? What's he like a professor of?
He's a professor of mansplaining is exactly what he's a professor right. of.
He's a professor of actually dot, dot, dot. And he wakes up at the beginning of this movie in Florence, Italy, in a hospital room. He does not know how he got there. He does not know why he has a massive wound on his head. He meets a doctor, Dr. Brooks, played by Felicity Jones. He doesn't know who she is either. He doesn't know anything. And she explains to him that he just was brought to the emergency room. She's taking care of him. But then this assassin comes to kill him. So Robert Langdon and Dr. Brooks go on the run to figure out who's trying to kill him, why they're trying to kill him, what he has forgotten in the last 48 hours, and trying to piece this all together. While at the same time, a billionaire played by Ben Foster believes that the planet is overpopulated and it's only going to get worse in the next 40 years. He is going to release a killer virus that is going to wipe out that problem. I think that's it. I think that's enough. And that's all you really need to know in the plot of this movie.
That was a yeoman's work, by the
thanks.
Way.
Thanks.
Yeah, you were like a plow horse on that.
It was. Yeah, because you do reach a point when describing these types of movies where you go, yeah, that's enough. That's good enough. I did something, loyal listeners, that I never do. When reviewing the third film in a series, and I'm only going to share it with you, I have not watched the first two movies in this series. I have not read any of the books. I think that's okay. I'm going to allow myself that for this film. Because I have to say that not having seen the first two movies, but generally getting the gist of them and knowing how kind of critically reviled they are, I feel kind of comfortable going into the movie the way that I did. And with all of that being said, and the slightly snotty tone I have while describing the plot of this movie, this is the type of movie that I find it very hard to hate, which I want to make very clear, is very distinct from actually liking a movie like this. To me, this is the type of kind of really sort of preposterous, ludicrous, kind of stupid, page-turning kind of thriller that, again, I don't like, but I kind of get a dopey kick out of watching because it is sort of stupid, and it's just about all of the ridiculous plot gimmicks that are thrown in there. As I mentioned in my New Republic review, this movie kind of has everything. It's got people who can't remember anything. It's got ridiculous character twists. It's got evil viruses that are going to wipe out like a third of the planet. It's got all these kind of like, and it's also got that globe-trotting kind of element to it. To take a movie like this seriously at all is a fool's errand. And on its own kind of stupid, idiotic terms, it's not bad. I actually kind of like the supporting cast a lot in this movie. It's got Felicity Jones, who I actually think is pretty decent, as basically being the doctor who knows just enough about Dante to be smart, but also to listen when Tom Hanks mansplains all the stuff as they go from Italy to Turkey in this movie. One of the supporting characters who I like a lot in this movie is played by an actress whose name I'm now going to officially botch. It's Sidsi Babbitt Knudsen, I believe. She was also in A Hologram for a King with Tom Hanks. And I actually like the rapport that they have in both of those movies. So I guess they are able to create kind of a rapport of characters who should fall in love with each other, but it's not going to work out in movies that I didn't much like. Inferno is stupid. You don't need me to tell you that. But that being said, if you are stuck having to see this on an airplane, because this movie really feels like a perfect I'm stuck on an airplane kind of movie, I think you can enjoy it on a very dumb level. But again, no human being needs to see this movie.
Well, I mean, if they were really obsessed with the first two, I mean, they feel like they've got to. Yeah, this is one of those movies where basically I find myself focusing a lot on Tom Hanks. You know, we just did these rankings for Tom Hanks movies for Vulture. And even in movies that are not good, he's always a steadying presence. He's always like, you always feel like you're in a professional's hands when Tom Hanks is the lead in the movie. And here, it's just so strange to see. But basically, Tom Hanks' role in this movie is to shout exposition while running up or down a staircase. That's pretty much what he's doing in this movie and pretty much all three of these movies. And, so to see him do that, I found for 2 hours, I found it mostly exhausting. Both Tom Hanks and Ron Howard, by the way, I love the fact that Ron Howard had like two movies released in October, by the way. Ron Howard did a documentary about the Beatles that's also released this month. So who knew that Ron Howard was just knocking these movies out like left and right. You know, I look at someone like Tom Hanks and someone like Ron Howard, who, whatever your thoughts about them, are certainly Hollywood professionals. These are people that, you know, they can make a movie particularly Howard, can make a movie in like an efficient, smart, not necessarily smart, but by the numbers, he's a studio hand. You know, he's an old pro. And I find it kind of a waste to have him. Not that Ron Howard is like, oh, well, this guy should be doing great cinema. But it does feel like, you know, we talked about this with The Accountant a little bit. One of the things that was really frustrating about The Accountant is, well, there's this movie for, like, adults. Then we just need, like, a steady studio director to make, and, like, a steady script to just be a perfectly average adult movie. And it couldn't do that. And I find, like, Ron Howard could make a movie like that. Ron Howard could keep you focused on the plot and just follow it straight through all the way. And he does that here, but it's so stupid that it just seems like such a waste of time. Like, congratulations, I guess. You were able to put together this stupid plot. Have one thing happen after another. That's one of the things I find frustrating with this. Is it feels like it's a waste of everybody's time to even be doing it in the first place. I will say a couple things because I agree with you. I mean, the movie's dumber than a box of shit, and like the first two, frankly. And I find it also just kind of baffling. I don't understand what the appeal of this movie is. I agree that it moves quickly. But I mean, I don't know why that's that appealing, I suppose. Like, it feels like if you're going to put this big scale of a production on, and you're right, there's a lot of good supporting actors. I particularly liked Irfan Khan, who actually has kind of the one kind of wild card role in the movie. He's the head of this, of course, as always, secret society of people that are actually the secret contractors who are out working for government agencies or whoever to control the way we think things. And he's kind of major in explaining what happens to Tom Hanks at the beginning of the movie, or Robert Langdon or whatever. You're Tom Hanks. We're going to call these, I'll tell you what, Tom, we're going to call these Tom Hanks' three terrible movies we never talk about. That's for that trilogy. But he has a kind of this fun little wild card role where he is, you know, he's the one person that's not affiliated with anybody. That's not like obviously in one direction or another. And he kind of has a good sense of humor and he comes and has fun with the role. He also gets into the one, I think, quiet theme the movie has, which is that young people are stupid and old people are smart. he actually has this great line when Tom Hanks is complaining about something that a young character has done. He says, yeah, honestly, I really just cannot stand young people. I find until like, they have to be like 35 until I can find them tolerable. And as I say, as I've gotten older, I found myself veering in that direction. It's kind of, I suppose it's a bad sign for my life that as I get older, I find myself commiserating more with elder characters in Ron Howard movies. Maybe that's a bad sign. But nevertheless, I thought that was kind of a fun, like, even with like the love story of the love story that you kind of talk about a little bit, like, it's clearly the theme of the movie is young people don't know what they're doing and old people have a better idea. It's not so much a theme as much as it is the thing that Ron Howard and Tom Hanks occasionally throw into the movie so they do not get too bored.
Yeah. One of the things I mentioned in the review that I wrote for us for the New Republic is that Tom Hanks, and we've talked about this, is beloved. When he makes a movie, he does talk shows, maybe he does Saturday Night Live. People are thrilled. People love Tom Hanks. But it's amazing that nobody talks about these movies. I have friends who are huge Tom Hanks fans who have never seen these movies. It's like this collective thing that we all just agree they don't exist. We have decided as a culture, oh, like that's just like a thing he does, but none of us talk about it. I think that's kind of fascinating in its own way that like people saw Larry Crown and will be like, oh God, Larry Crown sucked. But these movies are just sort of like, you know, there's sort of like Hillary Clinton supporters not wanting to talk about like the things that maybe you don't want to talk about with her. It's like, eh, let's just not mention it. Let's just agree that they don't exist. But I will say that I did, in terms of the movies from October that are geared to, I guess, grown-ups, I did find myself actually liking this better than either The Accountant or the Tom Cruise movie. By the way, as a quick side note, I love that Tyler Perry's movie beat both Tom Hanks's movie and Tom Cruise's movie at the box office on back-to-back weekends. But I actually liked Inferno better than those other two movies, The Accountant and Jack Reacher. In some ways, maybe just to own up to the fact that I had such low expectations that I kind of enjoyed this one on its own stupid terms better than those other two movies. But God, it's just, and here's the other thing. You asked me like what the appeal is. I think the appeal is like those stupid National Treasure movies where it's like, here's a puzzle. We solved the puzzle. Here's another puzzle. We solved the puzzle. It's like when you're 8 and figure out those types of like puzzle games. I think that's the allure. But the last like Angels and Demons came out like 8 years ago. Like, it's like, so I just don't know. And I think the box office reflects this. Nobody was missing this movie. Nobody was pining for this film to exist.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, too, I just think that this has happened for 3 straight movies now. The adult movies, the thrillers, the adult actioners, the things that are not, you know, that not to use the old cliche, but that are not teenage vampire movies, they're dumber than teenage vampire movies.
Yes.
These movies are all stupider than your average, I guess not Batman vs. Superman, but your average, honestly, your average superhero movie is so much smarter than these movies.
I mean, for me, the last thing I want to say is that the thing I find very worrying about both September and October, because I'm also thinking about Magnificent Seven in this conversation. You know, the summer was pretty terrible for mainstream movies. And so that perhaps was a hope that like, well, come award season, even these movies that aren't geared to awards will at least be kind of geared more to grown-ups. And so you'll have some better stuff. But Hollywood can't even seem to make these movies good either. It's been a very depressing year, I feel like, for like Hollywood mainstream movies. So I guess we're saying find Moonlight, see Moonlight, for the love of God.
Moonlight again.
Yeah, go see that.
But one last thing. I do kind of like Ben Foster's turn as Peter Thiel. I did kind of enjoy that idea.
Anything's better than Warcraft.
Yes, exactly. So, okay, so what'd you give it?
I gave it a meh C+.
Well, I gave it a C. C. Like, again, yeah, I agree with you. It's so stupid as to not be inoffensive, which is actually, I think, what it's the tattoo that I actually have across my back right now is so stupid as to not be inoffensive. So, hey, that's Inferno. I think we've covered Inferno. It's funny. I feel like we had more to talk about with Weekend at Bernie's than we did about Inferno. So, all right, let's move on to our reboot section. We got Inferno out of the way. There's all sorts of big movies coming out in the next few weeks that are going to be jam-packed. So let's not waste too much more time talking about Inferno. I think we actually just gave Inferno more thought than Tom Hanks or Ron Howard did. Also, Felicity Jones, I think she's never going to have to make a movie like this again after Star Wars. And so I'm very excited for her. She'll just never have to do this crap again.
Yeah, she has awesome hair. That's all I'll say. She has good hair That's in the awesome. Movie. Yeah, good job.
She has good hair. Tom Hanks, less so.
Yeah.
All right, so now we're going to go to our reboot section. Our first reboot movie is Jackie Brown.
Would you like to hear some music?
Sure.
Cool. You know, I couldn't wait to get home last night and wash the gel out of my hair.
Looks nice.
Thanks.
You never got into the whole CD revolution?
Oh, I got a few, but I can't afford to start all over again. I mean, I've invested too much time and money in my albums.
Yeah, but you can't get new stuff on records.
I don't get new stuff that often.
All right, so Jackie Brown came out in 1997. It was the third movie from, I guess, are we counting Four Rooms? Are we counting Four Rooms?
Four Rooms was after this, wasn't it?
So then either way, we're not counting Four Rooms. Jackie Brown is the third movie from Quentin Tarantino. It, of course, came out after Pulp Fiction, his massive, massive breakthrough. This one stars Pam Grier as Jackie Brown, also stars Samuel Jackson, Robert De Niro, Bridget Fonda, and the Oscar-nominated Robert Forster, along with Michael Keaton and several other people. It was Grier. I'm going to just kind of introduce. We talked about this a little last week, but I feel like the frame of our discussion about Jackie Brown needs to be our Tarantino history. I really do. I really think that's kind of an important thing because, obviously, you know, kids of the '90s, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, even were like, you know, very, you know, formative movies, I think, for both of us and kind of our movie experience. And to me, Pulp Fiction was such a massive hit, and a massive hit in every possible way for Tarantino's second movie. It was fascinating to see what he was going to do next. Like, that is a massive success that, you know, changed like the number of Pulp Fiction imitators that came afterward. It changed independent film. It changed actors' careers. John Travolta is still hanging around because of that movie. You know, there Samuel L. Jackson is basically still just playing Jules. So I think that think about the situation for Quentin Tarantino, then what his next movie is. This is a question that's vexed many filmmakers. I think Steven Soderbergh has talked about this a lot, about after you have, I think, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, like kind of what direction you go after that and how you do it. So Tarantino decided then to take an Elmore Leonard book called Rum Punch. And Elmore Leonard had been generally a great writer, but had been generally unsuccessfully kind of translated to movies. And he decided to take Rum Punch and Tarantinoize it, but still hew pretty closely to not only Leonard's book, but to Leonard's dialogue. And so what it did was it took all the stuff that people loved about Tarantino and merged it with someone else's work. And gave a movie to me, watching it again, I found deeply satisfying, deeply satisfying. And we both loved it at the time. Now, what happened after that? Because remember, Jackie Brown, it's funny, I was reading Roger Ebert's review of this movie, and his review is almost defensive. It's almost, people say that people talk, a lot of critics have said there's too much talking in this movie, and I just want these characters to talk and talk and talk, and I had to go back and look, and like, well, people were actually not lukewarm about Jackie Brown. I think they liked Jackie Brown. But there was a certain feeling among some people that it was a letdown after Pulp Fiction. And I believe, and I think you may agree with me on this, that this changed Tarantino. And this had him turn more in a, okay, I'm not going to have these long dialogue scenes that take a lot, and have this movie that takes a long time to develop and a lot of things that come together that moves a little bit slower than what you're used to. I need to floor it now for my next movies. I need to grab everybody's attention and just steer into every skid, and really all my indulgences, I need to indulge them. And that while I so that I think this movie was the pivot point for that career. Now, on one hand, I don't have a major problem with that because I feel that my favorite movie, Tarantino movie, is Inglourious Basterds. And the reason is it merges the great parts of Tarantino and Tarantino has so much talent and so much ambition that I almost don't want him to just make these movies. I think Jackie Brown is probably one of his most conventional movie, which is not meant to be a criticism at all. I love this movie. But I want him to take risks and to go crazy like he does with Inglourious Basterds, because I think the payoff, as with that movie, which I think is so great, is incredible. I think the payoff in Inglourious Basterds is over the top. Sometimes the payoff is not so over the top. It does not work out as well like Django Unchained or Hateful Eight. I think that is where his eyes get too big for his stomach. But I also feel like the reaction he had to Jackie Brown, I think, allowed him to do something great with Inglourious Basterds. But watching Jackie Brown, I did find myself going, man, you know, it would have been nice if he'd have stayed in this direction. Because this movie, to watch it now and watch all the hyper-caffeinated, hyper-kinetic Tarantino movies of the last 20 years, it feels mature and comfortable and lived in and patient in a way that Tarantino's movies, for better or for worse, have not been in 20 years. I have to say, there is not a second. And we can pick some nits in a bit. There was not a second of watching Jackie Brown again that I did not deeply enjoy.
That's very nice to hear, I have to say. long-time people who... I was just longtime followers. I'm like, who are those people? My wife, your wife? I don't know. Who would these people even be?
It's honestly just you and me.
Yeah. We've been having, I wouldn't even say a fight, because it really isn't even a fight. Because Will, I think you've articulated your history post Jackie Brown really nicely. Mine, just for the record, for the podcast, is that I have had a very tough time with Kill Bill and Inglourious Basterds and his parts
Death Proof.
Death Proof, yeah. And
which I also love. I love Death
you
Proof.
You love Death Proof.
Had issues with Hateful Eight and Django Unchained, yeah. But I think Death Proof is actually really good.
What I would say, very much simplifying it, is that the work that he has done since Jackie Brown is incredibly innovative, and it shows a massive talent, and I'm not entirely sure it's for me. Which, again, sounds incredibly glib and snotty, and I don't mean it that way. What I mean is that he has not made a film since then that I have not watched from beginning to end several times. Actually, Death Proof is the only one I have not seen multiple times. But those movies I have seen since Jackie Brown, I've gone, this is clearly an important, meaningful, explosive talent who is trying things and doing things and is often quite successful. But I do not feel a kinship to it in a way that I feel to other who I consider great filmmakers, whether it's David Fincher or, Paul Thomas Anderson or anybody
else.
Or
Soderbergh.
Or Soderbergh, frankly. There is something that just on a genetic level that there is no point, I think I can write about it persuasively and passionately. But as I get older, I become more and more comfortable with the idea that some filmmakers and some artists in general are for you and they're for other people and some aren't for you. And that is perfectly fine. That being said, going back and watching Jackie Brown, I went, yeah, this is my movie. I am not a person in general who believes in best movies versus favorite movies. And I actually kind of have a problem with that. My feeling is the movies that you like, those are in fact the best movies. And sometimes, depending on who you're talking to, I feel like the use of the word favorite is a way of saying, well, I don't want to really defend this because I know it's not considered that great. I just like it a lot. My feeling is, no, if you like that movie, it's the best. I think Tarantino is one of those examples, one of those rare exceptions where I actually would say, I don't think that Jackie Brown is perhaps his best movie, but it's definitely my favorite. And the reason why I'm watching it again, because I have not watched this movie in its entirety since I saw it back in during the Christmas holiday of 97. I just want to live in the world of this movie. And not only do I want to live in the world of this movie, because you could make that argument for other movies of his, I love these people. And as much as you could say that about some of his other movies in terms of the characters, I feel like I know these characters. And I don't, and this is where I think you and I kind of separate, Will, in terms of how we feel about his other movies. His other movies, as incredibly impressive and groundbreaking as they are, I look at those characters and go, they are movie characters, and they are very clever movie characters, but they are movie characters. They are not people. And again, that's a glib simplification, but that's kind of how I feel. I don't feel that way about Jackie Brown. As much as some of the characters might be kind of movie characters, they feel like people to me. And I would argue that as much as I love Pulp Fiction, and as much as I love Reservoir Dogs, this is the only movie that he has ever made to date that I, number one, feel something about in terms of I am actually concerned about what will happen to them, and number two, that I think about outside of the world of this movie. Even though I haven't seen this movie in about 20 years, I still think about some of these characters. And as I get older, I definitely think about the Robert Forrester and Pam Grier characters. One of the things I love about this movie is that it feels like it is small scale in a way that his movies stop being afterwards. I would argue that what happened after this movie is that Tarantino really, really embraced the influences that made him a filmmaker. And so when you see something like Kill Bill, or you see something like Django Unchained, or something like Inglourious Basterds, you are totally taken up and swept away by the vision of those movies and the execution of those movies. But you watch those movies and you think, I know what he's drawing from. In Jackie Brown, though, there's a little bit of an element of blaxploitation, though not very much. This movie actually feels like a movie that is set in the real world. And I feel like, to his detriment, the movies he has done since then have been disconnected from the real world. And even though they're visually impressive and creatively really, really well done, I will confess, I have never felt an emotional connection to the degree that I do in this movie. I'll stop there because I want to make this be a monologue. But in terms of just how I relate to this movie, our reviewer who wrote that really nice review, I agree with him. I think Jackie Brown is a stronger, deeper, richer movie for the things that, frankly, he has stopped doing since he made this movie.
You know, and again, to defend Tarantino and my... And to be fair, I've had a harder time with his last two movies because I feel that this is... He's gone too far in this direction. Like, to me, Inglourious Basterds was the pinnacle of it, because this was... I mean, just the audaciousness of doing that movie in the first place and going that direction. Like, that's a movie that has all of Tarantino's crazy influences, but also is in the gift shop at the Holocaust Museum. Like that is a movie that is a... somehow balances all of these plates and is completely satisfying, and also goes down every single little route that Tarantino wants to go, rabbit hole. To me, the existence of Inglourious Basterds is proof of my concept, which is that as much as I enjoy Jackie Brown, I'm glad he was willing to disconnect from the real world and go down his rabbit holes, because I feel like that's a peak that makes this movie a little bit better than Jackie Brown. Because Jackie Brown, as great, and I think it's probably even more perfect than Inglourious Basterds, it has fewer flaws than Inglourious Basterds, but I feel like the ceiling of it is not quite as high as Inglourious Basterds go. But so that's my defense against because I don't believe he should have just kept making Jackie Brown type movies. Because you wonder, an alternative universe where Jackie Brown is a bigger hit than Pulp Fiction, if he's a more relaxed filmmaker, right? Like, there was a backlash to Jackie Brown. That was a major backlash, but clearly it was wait, is Tarantino slowing down, or his movie's not going to be? Where's the hypodermic needle to the heart scene and all that stuff? Like, it is a slower movie, and you wonder if that was a reaction to that. But man, like, as I love... Also, first of all, you talk about responding to Robert Forster character. They're like in their mid-40s.
Yeah, swallow hard, buddy. Yeah. Well, she is. He's in his 50s. But yes, when she says that she's 44, that's a swallow hard moment for people like you and me. Yeah.
Yes, yikes. But to me, you know, that is... Think about how comfortable this movie is with itself. You know, there's only one movie. There's always that one movie in Tarantino's movies, whether it's his cameo or whether it's hey, look, I've got Mike Myers in this movie, where you're like, you get taken out of the movie because Tarantino is doing something he probably shouldn't. There's only one in this, and that's literally just when when Tarantino does the voice of the answering machine. He has the voice of the answering machine in Pam Grier's apartment. And you're like, oh, get out of here. Get out of here, Tarantino. I was in the movies world. Get out of here. But other than that, you are engrossed in this movie. To me, one of the key parts that makes this movie so great, everyone in this movie is smart. Like, some of them are smarter than others, and some of them will certainly make mistakes. But everybody in this movie is smart. And more importantly, everyone in this movie is thinking. This is a movie where there are scenes, and Ebert wrote about this in his review, where people just stop for a second and just think for a second. And the idea of that that feels like its own bit of audaciousness for Tarantino to do that. And this is, here's an argument, Grierson. Is this the last kind of great De Niro performance? He's so good in this movie, yes, right? Like, yeah. He's so perfect in this movie, and perfect in the way that De Niro is. Like, he actually gets into this character a little bit. There's no, you have to keep reminding yourself that it's De Niro. There's no like big De Niro moments. He really kind of shuts himself down and plays this guy who used to be this really excellent crook, but has just gotten rusty and has just gotten slower and has just gotten adjusted to being out in the real world. And he plays that with a certain dignified, understated sadness that, while also being kind of an ass himself, that is really subtle. And I have to say, really, I was stunned by how much I liked De Niro in this movie.
Yeah, what's funny about watching this movie now, and I totally agree with everything you just said about De Niro, but what's really funny is that he's actually the third, I was about to say he's the third Heat, my 30 Rock reference is coming out. He's the third element in the movie of characters who are getting older and not knowing what to do with themselves. And I hadn't realized it at the time when I first saw it. Because even like some of the stuff that he says is like, he's also in his own way kind of dealing with what Pam McGrier's character is dealing with, Robert Forrester's character about, oh shit, now what? And
well, I mean, for what it's worth, Bridget Fonda's Melanie's going through the same thing.
Yeah.
The idea that she used to be this stoner beach girl and now she's getting a little bit older, and what's her utility now? What does she do now? Is her goal really just to sit and smoke pot all day?
Yeah, I mean, there's a great piece to write, and as I was watching this last night, I was sort of thinking about, is that one of the reasons why Samuel L. Jackson, who's also fantastic in this movie, one of the reasons why he is the true bad guy in the movie is that he is the only person who doesn't seem to question his own life. Everybody else in the movie, actually, the other four, I mean, Michael Keaton's kind of a separate character, so that he doesn't really count, but of the five kind of central characters in the movie, Samuel Jackson is the only one who doesn't really kind of question, who am I? What am I doing in my life? And in some ways, that's great because he has a certainty that nobody else in the movie has. But it's really interesting to have a movie, and the thinking part is so dead on, Will, because everybody else is really kind of going, oh man, like, this is not what I was sort of thinking this was going to be. And what's funny is that, as I'm thinking this out loud, Bridget Fonda's character kind of talks about that in terms of Samuel Jackson. Because when it's just the two of them, her and Robert De Niro, and De Niro says, like, well, he seems to know a lot about this gun stuff. She's like, he's just repeating stuff he's heard. Like, even he's kind of doing an act. Even he's kind of, like, pretending in a way. And this, I mean, I think what you said, I think, really dovetails into what I was saying about there is a sense of, even when people are talking or thinking, there is an emotional undercurrent of, what's going on here? What's this actually about? Because the only, you know, nit I would pick in this movie is that I would say that the actual planning of the actual how we're going to exchange the money, it's mostly good, but it does feel a little drawn out. But I would almost say that I forgive that because when there are lags in the movie, it's mostly because of character stuff. And it's more about getting to see the characters kind of hang out. And you want to talk about a thinking scene. I had actually forgotten how great that scene is. When De Niro and Samuel L. Jackson drive off in the car together, because I remember the whole thing where, like, you know,
After the heist.
And I remembered I shot her because she was being annoying. I remembered that. I'd actually forgotten where they stop and Samuel L. Jackson goes, wait a second. this is probably what happened. And then De Niro says,
it's Jackie.
Yeah. And then he says, it's Jackie. And he says, wait a second, I saw that guy. And it's such a great moment of the dawning of the lights. In terms of like this being a pivot point for Tarantino, this very much feels like the end of the LA era for Tarantino, because, you know, Reservoir Dogs is in LA. Right. It's about a heist gone wrong. Pulp Fiction is set in LA. It's kind of about a heist gone wrong. And this movie isn't about a heist gone wrong exactly, but it's of that series. And I would agree with you. And this is the thing I want to say about valuing an artist like Tarantino, even if his movies aren't for me. I agree. If he had made 8 more Jackie Browns, I don't think I'd be saying right now in 2016, well, thank goodness he kept making movies like that. The value in artists like Tarantino is that he keeps pushing and going in different directions. And it's funny to watch Jackie Brown now and say, yeah, it's really the end of an era of those 3 movies of him doing a certain type of thing. And then he gives other people other types of movies that maybe don't do much for me, but obviously, like, you know, to use you as an example, really respond to. And I think it's something else I really want to talk about really quickly that I think is so interesting that you mentioned. Just in terms of evaluating things that you like and what matters and what doesn't matter, I think Jackie Brown's kind of interesting about this idea that it's more perfect in a way than, say, Inglourious Basterds are, because there are fewer flaws in Jackie Brown than there's something like Inglourious Basterds, but it peaks higher. The way you said that I really love, because it gets to this idea of what we value, because I prefer Jackie Brown in this instance, because I like the fact that it does less things that bug me. Whereas, yeah, Inglourious Basterds, there's no moment in Jackie Brown that's as fantastic as the first chapter of Inglourious Basterds. That chapter is better than anything.
And there's nothing nearly as audacious as the last chapter.
Yes, there's nothing as absolutely like gutsy crazy. Though it's funny to watch Jackie Brown, I have to say, and think, oh, in some ways, that's the ending of Jackie Brown in terms of how they do the stuff in the mall. It's the baby steps towards doing what he does in Inglourious Basterds so terrifically. But it's interesting, this idea of sometimes how we put things above other things. Sometimes the audacious, gutsy thing is more, you'd enjoy it more than the thing that's a little more perfect. Where in this case, Jackie Brown, because there are fewer things I think that it steps wrong in, I'll take that more. And so it's interesting, I think, in terms of how we kind of like pick and choose those things about what we kind of respond to and what we don't respond to.
So, well, I am so glad. I'm so glad we did this movie. I just had an absolute blast to watch it again. And I want to note, by the way, I wrote about this movie a couple years ago. There was a movie called Life of Crime that came out in 2013, directed by a man named Daniel Schechter. And it stars Jennifer Aniston and Will Forte and Tim Robbins. But it also stars as younger versions of the Melanie, Lewis, and Ordell characters. Mostef plays a young Ordell, John Hawkes plays a young Lewis, and Isla Fisher plays a young Melanie. And I found, watching that movie 3 years ago, well, when it came out, I was like, hey, I'd forgotten how much I loved those 3 characters, and how much the movie is not great, but it's just kind of fun to see those young characters again. So if you love Jackie Brown, I think you'd be remiss not to go look at Life of Crime just to see those 3 characters. I get it basically in the 70s. So it's kind of a fun.
And the last thing I want to say is that, you know, of course, when this movie came out, it wasn't the only movie that kind of drew Spike Lee's ire, but this movie and Pulp Fiction combined, A certain word, shall we say, that's used a lot in this movie, angered Spike Lee. I have to say, I watched this movie with an eye towards, does it feel exploitative or kind of ridiculous? I have to say, I really did not find it that way. I felt like it was so organic to these characters. And I would also add that I think that this movie is actually, without making a big deal out of it, I think this movie is actually pretty dead on about racial tension just in Los Angeles, but sort of like in the culture in general, because the black characters that you come across have so, when they have to like encounter a white character, like usually, I don't think it's a mistake that or an accident that the white characters tend to be the law enforcement officers in this movie. I think that Tarantino actually is pretty smart about how he kind of handles that. The fact that Pam Grier, they keep mentioning that, you know, you're 44, it's going to be tough for you to find another job. The fact that she's black, I think, is an element that they never say, but is actually an element that I think you as a viewer think about. Because if she was white, I would submit she wouldn't have as tough a time. I think that the movie actually is pretty, again, without making a big deal out of it, pretty smart about that stuff. So I don't know if you thought about that while watching the movie, but I have to say, I think Tarantino handles it pretty good.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And I just, the last thing is, I feel bad we've talked this long about Jackie Brown and have barely touched on Robert Forster, who is just so perfect in this movie. And it's funny, this was the time of who's Tarantino, who's his career going to resurrect next? And so on. And I remember when Forster was cast, because obviously we were still, there's still this big Tarantino obsession at the time. Robert Forster was cast. It was like, oh, he's like the new Travolta. Like, they're going to resurrect like Travolta. But to me, like, that's a sign of Tarantino not doing gimmick casting like he would occasionally do later in movies, to be honest, but realizing, no, this guy is the exact right guy to play this role. And he's perfect start to finish.
Yeah, he's terrific. Pam Grier. You're talking about a character who's thinking. She's always thinking in this movie. One of my favorite scenes in this entire movie is when I had forgotten it, when she actually goes into the changing room and she just looks into the mirror. It's a little bit of an echo of the scene from Reservoir Dogs where Tim Roth stops and looks in the mirror and says, they don't know. They don't know a fucking thing. Because at that moment, he's actually trying to, you know, psych himself up for the undercover role that he's playing. What's even greater, I think, in Jackie Brown is she doesn't say a thing, but the look tells you everything. It's a fantastic movie, so I'm so glad to have the excuse to revisit it.
Awesome. So that is Jackie Brown. Everyone go see Jackie Brown. It's really, really good. It is, just the last thing on it, it is so funny to watch. If you've not seen it in 20 years, there are times it almost doesn't feel like a Tarantino movie. Like, he's still infused every part of it, but it's just so different than the direction he's gone. Definitely just go see it. So, all right, so that's our reboot section, Jackie Brown. So our next movie and our final reboot section of the week is Bottle Rocket.
Okay, escape route is crucial, just in case somebody is tailing us or even chasing us, as the case may be. We can't be sure how it is going to happen.
Do you think that we're going to be chased tonight? Is that a possibility?
That's a good question. No, I don't think we're going to be chased. I'm just being hypocritical here. However, I will say, Bob, please don't interrupt me, man, because I'm trying to stay focused on this stuff. You're responsible for the external situation tomorrow, streets and the getaway.
Whoa. Excuse me, are the explosives really necessary here? I think it'd be a lot more simple if I just walk up to the door alone. I think that would be...
Why are you undermining me, man?
How much bullets does this thing take?
Bob, look, please, I'm paying attention.
God damn it! You're not paying attention if you're messing around with the gun. Now quit!
Bottle Rocket was the first feature film directed by Mr. Wes Anderson. He had made a short film of this first and then turned it into a feature-length film. Came out in February of 1996. I remember seeing it in the theater opening night. A bunch of newcomers, essentially, were the stars of this movie. It starred co-writer Owen Wilson and his brother Luke Wilson, the Don't Play Brothers, in this movie. Also Robert Musgrave. They are three buddies who are kind of, sort of, like thieves, but they're just, like, not super great at it. You know, we had this whole conversation just now about Jackie Brown in terms of Tarantino and where that was in his career. I think the same thing can be done as a entry point in terms of talking about Bottle Rocket, because what's funny about watching Bottle Rocket now, I had not watched it from beginning to end since 96, dear God. It's fascinating to watch this movie now. In relation to where Wes Anderson has gone since then. I had, you know, expressed reservations about where I think Tarantino has gone in his career since Jackie Brown. I actually would submit that I think Wes Anderson has gotten better and better as a filmmaker. In terms of my own favorite Wes Anderson films, my all-time favorite is Fantastic Mr. Fox. My second favorite is his most recent movie. And then the third one is sort of a weird wild card. I Love Darjeeling Limited, which is a bit of a divisive movie in his catalog. But I think he's gotten stronger and more emotional and richer as a filmmaker. And I have to say that watching Bottle Rocket didn't dissuade me from that opinion. I still think it's good, but to me, it feels like the baby steps of a filmmaker. It feels like my first movie, not my first movie. I mean, like Mike Mattel's My First Movie. It feels like a director trying things out and trying to kind of figure out a style that he will sharpen and in some ways perfect as his career goes on. Much like we were saying about with Jackie Brown, one of the things is what you're saying about watching Bottle Rocket is it feels in some ways removed from some of the Wes Anderson tics. If you remember from a couple years ago when Saturday Night Live did their horror spoof of Wes Anderson movies, this is the movie that doesn't really fall into the things that they're spoofing a little bit, but not so much. And it's refreshing, but it's also a movie, you know, this movie came out in 96. Jackie Brown comes out in 1997. Bottle Rocket very much, I think, feels like a movie that, though it's Wes Anderson-ish in a lot of ways, feels almost more connected to what felt like a 90s indie movie. It's about a heist. It's about, you know, guys who are smart, but also kind of quirky and kind of goofy, and it's very kind of dialogue-heavy. It's more about the characters and the plot. This movie feels like it's coming out of the Tarantino world in a certain way, except it's funnier, and it's also got that Wes Anderson edge that he would find more as he went along. It's really fun to watch a very young Owen Wilson and a very young Luke Wilson kind of trying in some ways to sort of discover the personas that they would later kind of capitalize on when they had Hollywood careers. I find this movie charming. I think it's fun. I kind of feel the same way that I did when I saw it in 1996, which is, it's good, but I wasn't necessarily blown away by it. I was not like, say, Martin Scorsese was, who put it on his top 10 movies of the 1990s and really talked about Wes Anderson sort of being the future, one of like the great future directors. I think that was later to come. I'm not sure it's entirely there in Bottle Rocket.
Yeah, you know, it feels like a young man's movie.
Yeah.
It feels like, and even in plot-wise, like this is about a young man's journey, and it's funny how much more poignant that the journey of Rushmore feels just by making that character like 10 years younger. Like by making that character, because I think there's a lot of similarities between the Luke Wilson character and the main character in Rush and the main character Rushmore, but there's a couple times where you're watching this movie and it's just like, hey, man, get it together. Like the Luke Wilson character has a little bit of a, there's a couple times where the Luke Wilson character is not entirely different than what you might see in Garden State. There's like a little bit of that. There's a little bit of this, like, I'm so sad. I'm such a mopey guy at the middle. And it feels like a young man working shit out movie in ways that I found myself to have a lot less patience for than I thought I was going to. A lot of the elements are there, but it's not as disciplined as his other movies would become. It kind of goes off in these tangents. Your Tarantino thing is exactly right. It feels like it, like the obviously the universes of Wes Anderson and Quentin Tarantino seem like light years apart. But this, you know, this was the time where, like in the afterwards of Pulp Fiction, like the idea that, like, why does this movie have a heist exactly? Like there's like a little bit of like, we need to, like, if you look at the cover, look at the posters back then, like there's guns, like they're firing guns off in the distance. Like this was things to do in Austin when you're dead or something. So, you know, it does have like a little bit of that feel. And I feel like the thing that he did right with Rushmore, which I like more than you do, and I still feel like it's one of his best movies, is he kind of shed off that stuff. He's like, okay, this is going to be about me now. And he got a little bit more control of it. He got just more confident as a filmmaker. This feels like it was made cheaply, and it shows like clear talent, but it doesn't feel like Anderson is such a meticulous director. I can imagine him going back and watching this now and like scratching at his face.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting to kind of wonder how. I didn't do any research in terms of if people have asked him recently about this movie. In terms of all the heist stuff, there was a part of me, because it was based on a short film that he made initially, if there was a little part of him back then that thought, what's big right now? Heist movies. I'll do one of those to kind of get my name out there, because, I mean, I guess Fantastic Mr. Fox has heist elements to it, but it definitely doesn't feel...
Definitely.
Yeah, it's definitely sort of a kind of a different thing. I mean, I think the thing that's most, beyond what you've already kind of mentioned, that's most Wes Anderson about is this idea of... Usually it's family in his movies, the bond, the complexity or the complex bonds of families and how difficult and how complicated that can be. This time it's more about like friend bonds. So it's a little bit kind of different, but that kind of like middle ground between like a drama and a comedy where it's sort of like funny, but not funny. Ha ha. But kind of like that wistfulness of like not being able to make connections with other people. Like that's the thing that makes me most feel like, oh, right. Like this is totally a Wes Anderson movie. The other thing that I have to say, and I hate kind of like re-legislating these movies after they, you know, 20 years afterwards. I mentioned that Darjeeling Limited is one of my favorites of his movies. One of the big criticisms against or about that movie is that kind of puts like, oh, look, like the privileged white guys going off to India and like hanging out with the Indian people. And there's a sort of a, people find that kind of annoying. I actually think that the movie doesn't play that way. I think in Darjeeling Limited, those guys are not very bright, and they go someplace in the hopes of finding some sort of like higher, like consciousness or whatever. But can I say that in Bottle Rocket, it is kind of bug me a little bit now.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's a thing that he's done in his other movies. Royal Tenenbaums has it, where he will have, for lack of a better way of describing it, foreign characters who are quirky and talk funny. It didn't bother me so much in Royal Tenenbaums because I thought that character was really funny. There is a little element of this movie. You know what I'm talking about. Like, oh, she can't speak English and she's adorable. And the other guy who works at the hotel, he can speak English and can translate, but we talked about in Jackie Brown, that movie being smart. It's a pretty dumb plot point in this movie that Owen Wilson can't figure out what the hotel guy is saying when he says, I love you. That stuff, yeah. I would simply say, to be kind, I think he got better at it as he went along in his movies, or at least thought about it in a way that doesn't feel thought through in this movie.
Yeah, the bullies are like that too. Like the kind of bully plotline thing, I don't think is really as clever as well. Also, James Caan, like that James Caan doesn't quite, he's fine, but like James Caan is like almost a little bit too far in Napoleon Dynamite territory as opposed to Wes Anderson territory, whereas like someone like Gene Hackman later would nail that. Like I feel like James Caan is not quite right. And he's just not quite, everyone's just fine tuning the buttons here and they're all figuring it out. And later, and if anything, Wes Anderson is a guy that definitely has like a specific spot and definitely is, as I said, meticulous and kind of fine tunes it down. This is a movie where he doesn't quite have it, but you can still see some of the larger themes. And to me, I was trying to like come up with, okay, how did he get from this to the next couple of movies? And to me, what this movie is really about, it's about these two characters who I think probably have some sort of connection to Wes Anderson and Owen Wilson themselves. The problems they have is every single time that their fantasy life has to come into collision with reality. Like, that's really what keeps happening. Dignan has all of these crazy plans, and Luke Wilson wants to, like, he has this theoretical, idealized world, and then the real world collides with it, and it's not as simple, as easy as he wanted it to be. And my overarching crazy dorm room theory on this is that was, you know, later, this is one of the few movies, I think one of the last movies, where Wes Anderson's universe collides with the real dingy planet. And after that, that fantasy world these characters have, they escape into it. And I don't have a complaint about that. I like the world that Wes Anderson created. But this is the last time where it feels like these characters are in our actual physical universe that you could run into on the street. And later, and I think to great effect, he would float off into his fantasy world and to his specific little, like, the dollhouse theory that people always talk about with him. That it is his place, and that the fantasy world ultimately won in those future movies, where this is the last time they had to deal with actual dingy people.
Yeah, I think that's dead on. And it's funny that we have a Tarantino movie and a Wes Anderson movie on the same podcast, because in sort of a very crude way, that's what they've both done. They both have just created dollhouses that they want to like make their films in. I mean, I love Grand Budapest Hotel. I mean, I think that movie is fantastic. That movie is nothing but an artificial universe. And the Ray Fiennes character, I think, is one of the best things that Ray Fiennes has done, but also Wes Anderson in terms of a creation. Even in that movie, that character is about wanting to live in the world of that hotel and then having the messiness of a World War II environment invading that and how he kind of deals with that. So it's a theme. It's definitely a theme. So it's, you know, it's encouraging to watch something like Bottle Rocket and go, don't worry, it's going to get better. Like this is a fine start, but it's going to get better from here.
All right. So that's Bottle Rocket. I enjoyed watching it, but I definitely thought like, yep. Yeah. I'm glad he improved. I'm glad he got better. It's funny. And then the other movie, of course, Jackie Brown is, they're such different filmmakers than who they are now. And one can argue for better or for worse. So that is Bottle Rocket. Good reboot section.
Yeah. Solid. I'm sure people would, there'd be people who listen like Bottle Rocket's the best thing Wes Anderson ever did. And after that, he went crazy, you know? So yeah.
Yeah. Which I think is very wrong. Yeah. All right, so that's Bottle Rocket. So that is the show, Grierson. I always say we're going to get under an hour, and we never do. But we dug in deep into Jackie Brown, and I'm really glad we did. We had a lot of stuff to discuss on that one.
Yes. This was a fruitful hour, I would say.
It was a fruitful hour, exactly. Otherwise, I'm just still trying to figure out this Rubik's Cube. So, like, finally, I made productive time.
Oh, you're in luck. Tom Hanks is here to explain it to you.
So, all right, so that's the show this week. Next week, there's three big movies being released, but we're only going to talk about two of them, and there's a reason for that. The first is Doctor Strange, which is the big Marvel movie with Benedict Cumberbatch, and it's, you know, it's Marvel, man. It's the big Marvel movie. Of course, we're going to talk about that. The second movie we're going to talk about is Hacksaw Ridge. It stars Andrew Garfield and Vince Vaughn, Cubs fan Vince Vaughn.
Maybe you heard, yes.
Yes, and directed by Mel Gibson. That's kind of the ongoing Mel Gibson Gibsonissance, maybe. and
trademark pending. Yeah, we're
trademark pending, very pending. So that is a movie. We'll get into that movie. That's another wide release next week. The third movie, Grierson's going to review it for the New Republic this week, but we're not going to talk about it next week. Is Loving, which is directed by Jeff Nichols, who we have already discussed two of his movies on this podcast. And Jeff Nichols is one of those filmmakers that's a big enough filmmaker and a talented enough filmmaker that Grierson and I have been having, like Tarantino and like Wes Anderson, having like a series of conversations about his work and what directions it's gone here and what directions it's gone there. So I really want to dig into that, but I'm not going to get a chance to see Loving in the next week because I'm still at the World Series. So because of that, we're not going to discuss Loving next week. We're not going to do the I ask Grierson questions or he shuts me off and just reviews the movie because I actually want to have a good, solid conversation with Grierson about that. And then our reboot movie, we have one reboot movie. The reboot movie is Snatch. From 2000, written and directed by Guy Ritchie, starring Benicio del Toro, Dennis Farina, Vinnie Jones, Jason Statham, and Brad Pitt. This was back when I only knew Guy Ritchie as Madonna's husband. We'll be back next week to discuss all of those movies. And, you know, Grierson, here's an interesting thing. Next week's show will be posted on Election Day. It will be posted on Election Day. So that'll be fun.
I'm singing the lyrics to Werewolf Bar Mitzvah in my head to make myself feel better right now. So it's I recommend it to everyone. It's very,
well, actually
it's very
idea.
Soothing. Very soothing. You're doing it right now. I know you are.
I am. Right, it's totally helping. Yeah. It's totally helping. We're going to be definitely ending the show with that this week. All right, Kirsten, have a good week. We'll be back next week with Doctor Strange, Hacksaw Ridge, and Snatch. Have a good week, Kirsten.
Oh, man, Trey, look up at the sky. It's a full moon on the Sabbath.
This is scary.
Break it down.
I was working late on my Haftorah when I heard a knock on my bedroom door. I opened it up, and to my surprise, there was a werewolf standing there with glowing gold eyes. He says, "Tomorrow, my son, you will be a man. But tonight's the time to join the Wolfen Clan. Tomorrow you will stand at the beamer and pray. But tonight, let's gaze at the moon and bathe. Werewolf for mitzvah, spooky, scary. Wolves becoming men, men becoming wolves. Werewolf for mitzvah, spooky, scary. Wolves becoming men, men becoming wolves."
All right, that was great, Trey. Okay, it's over. That's a wrap.
Oh. The next day, what happened? The Toma didn't teach.
Oh,
I got up in front of everyone to give my little speech. Then my teeth turned into fangs and my nails into claws. And I nearly dropped the Torah when my hands turned into paws. I growled and I roared and my rabbi did as well. It was a rocking werewolf zoo at Temple Beth Emanuel.
Hey man, where'd you learn all these Jewish words?
My manager, Harvey Lemmings. Werewolf bar mitzvah, spooky, scary. Boys becoming men, men becoming wolves.
I just don't think the idea of the song can sustain itself for that long. It seems a little sweaty now, so.
This whole premise is sweaty. We had a reception at the Larchmont Country Club. They served a real nice brisket and an 8-foot party sub. I danced with my cousins, I got money from my folks. We had a lot of fun making circumcision jokes. Then I remembered the premise of my song. I was at a nice reception, but the werewolf part was gone. So we pulled ourselves together and we're wolfmen again. Just in time for monster fight to begin.
No.
All the country club employees were brain-sucking packed. Who had all turned into zombies and were on the attack.
No.
So we fought them and some Draculas and Frankensteins too. Cause you gotta love bar mitzvah even if you're not a...
There's no such thing as Frankensteins.
Werewolf bar mitzvah, spooky, scary.
No plural.
Boys becoming men, men becoming wolves. Werewolf bar mitzvah, kooky, hairy. Boys becoming men. Men becoming wolves. I don't want this. I don't like this. This is scary. Turning into werewolves and stuff. You know?
I don't know, Trey. I'm not feeling it. This ain't no dick in a box. Mazel tov.